Movies Podcast. I am your host, Tyler Bielman. I'm joined by the immortal Scaff Elias.
Hello.
And the indomitable Richard Garfield.
At your service.
And first of all, we'd like to thank everybody for their patience with the audio quality of the last two podcasts. They were we were a little bit challenged, but I think we've got it sorted out now. Yeah?
Hopefully.
And
none of this speaking is going to make sense if you have to tape a preamble of "We're sorry we messed it up again."
No, I'll just edit this part out. If I have all the power in the editing room. That's why you always come off like, well, such a great guy that you are.
Cool.
And I want to give a shout out to a guy named Corey McCorick, who did help me out trying to sweeten the audio. And we'll put a link to his design website in the show notes. How's everybody been doing? You guys just got back from a trip, didn't you?
Yeah, we were just in China for 5 days, talking to Giant, a large game company over there.
How big exactly?
They are Giant. They're pretty big.
Giant Interactive, I think, is the full name.
And did you have fruitful conversations or anything you can talk about to the 6 or 7 people listening?
I don't know if there's anything we can talk about. It's an interesting potential market, and they were very interested in what we had to say.
They were gracious hosts, and were very appreciative. We each gave a talk, and one of the questions that they asked us, I think, is one of the questions that you're about to ask us.
Well, that's an incredible segue. I was going to ask where your sneakers went, but that's probably not the question you're talking about.
They didn't ask us that question.
Well, what happened to your sneakers? I love your sneakers, and you don't have them anymore.
When I was in China, a small village outside of Shanghai where people were eating out of the garbage and stuff, I was accosted by several very old shoeshine ladies, probably whose sum total net worth was about $1.74, and they laughed at my shoes. Literally, they could not stop laughing at my shoes. So that, I figured, was a pretty good time for me to maybe buy a new pair.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they got through to you when I couldn't get through to you for so many months telling you to buy new shoes. Any stories from the trip, Richard? Anything you want to share?
I got nothing.
Okay. I'll edit that part out. all right, guys. So
was there anything interesting we ate?
That we ate some good stuff, but
we did eat some good stuff. I don't know if we ate anything interesting though.
Five days seems
blood
like
blood soup.
Well, the blood soup. The hot
pot. Wait. Slow it down, people. blood soup.
That was actually the best thing we ate. The chicken blood soup. It was really good.
Is that it? Was it what it sounds like?
Yes.
As far as we know, for all I mean.
Listen, it was either that or something worse.
Why would they tell us it was that if it wasn't that?
That's a good point. By the way, just for the record. Hell or High Watermelon Wheat Beer, the stock prices have jumped since our mention. I wanted to throw that out there.
Well, then we should be throwing out feelers for other sponsors, right?
Yes. If you'd like to sponsor the Games with Garfield podcast, drop us a line at one of the links. Anyway, so what's wrong with you?
We're smooth
operators. But that's not why you called. So we're going to talk today about a topic in game design, one that in particular for me is I'm right up against it. I work on a game called Arcane Legions, which is a tabletop miniatures game, and we released the product about a month ago, and we are grappling with the power level of the range units in our army in the game system, and we. As we've been interpreting what to do and interpreting the data from the players and going through the mathematical stuff, we're considering nerfing the range units. So there's this term nerfing. Do you guys do either of you know that where that term came from? Nerfing?
No, do not, or did not until you pointed it out.
I was setting you up to sound smart, Richard. Tell the people where it came from.
I only like to sound smart on my own natural capabilities.
So according to the vast amount of research I did before the show, nerfing was a term that came out of Ultima Online, one of the first sort of major massively multiplayer online RPGs. Back in, when was Ultima Online? 91, something like that?
No, 96.
Not that early.
Six.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
Okay. Would be my guess or something.
96
like
sounds good
maybe,
to me.
Maybe later.
Like I said, 96, 97. And the and apparently they had to reduce the power of the swords in the melee combat system, and the players complained about it, saying that they had turned their weapons into Nerf weapons. And that's at least, as far as I can tell, where the term came from. If anyone has a different story about where the term nerfing came from as it pertains to games, feel free to drop a line in the comments, and we'll check that out. So
and you're not talking about football.
Like, I was not talking about football.
I thought it was first used in football. They tried to replace the footballs in real football with Nerf footballs, and then they started talking about them having nerfed the football.
I went
back to the real thing.
I had not heard that version, but damn it, Richard, if you say that's how it went.
Because a Nerf football is not as powerful as the real football.
We used to put firecrackers into Nerf toys and shoot them at each other. Was that?
So you unnerfed them.
We would unnerf them. Yeah, specifically.
So for you, nerf carries this power connotation.
Yes.
Like you nerfed my sword. All right.
All right.
I couldn't pack explosives into my sword when it was metal, but now that it's nerfed.
Yeah, and I flinch every time I see something kind of neon orange coming at me.
Making that sound?
Yeah. So nerfing
call my sword foam dynamite.
Dynamite. You don't often get a Jimmy J.J. Walker reference into a podcast. Moving on.
You probably more often than most people,
that's
though.
That's fair. Good times. So, if you're going to laugh, put the mic up to you. So at least I get to laugh. All right. So it's a controversial topic. People get very emotionally invested in the games they play. Games that are open-ended, that have persistence over a long period of time, when there are changes to those kind of game systems, people, understandably, get upset. So through the course of thinking about this topic, what do you reckon was probably the earliest nerfing of a game system by either a play group or a company?
It's a complicated question, because how exactly do you define nerfing? Is it something that you do with objects in these extensible game systems, in which case you've got a lot of it going on in I think miniatures games and probably role-playing games. Errata published in all these, various military simulation games from the 80s, 70s, 60s even, I would guess, something like that. But if you think of it more generally, as changes that you need to make to the rules to stop broken things from happening
after it's published,
then I guess you could go back to rules changes in sports.
Interesting.
Maybe if you think of the teams as your players, and your players as objects, from those players, then there's certain types of objects, like say George Mikan, who the rules need to be, he needs to be nerfed. So the rules.
He was great in Wham, by the way. he was my second favorite guy in that band.
Yeah.
Your second favorite.
Yeah, that's
wasn't he the H in Wham?
Maybe, I don't know. The Scrabble podcast was a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so then you've got rules changes in these sports, because you have essentially objects in the sports, let's say a skilled big man who's wrecking the way you want the game to go. So you have to add a 3-second rule and widen the foul lane and things like that.
So this is basketball we're talking about.
Basketball. Or role-playing games.
Widening the foul lane in D&D. I don't remember that. So that's interesting. So you think it goes back to sports.
I think the real thing is any game that's played over a long period of time by a large number of players, the original set of rules ain't going to cut it. So you need to evolve the rules as the player base begins to figure out more and more about the game.
And
yeah, there's probably two connotations there which need to be addressed, though. The There's changing the rules, and then there's changing, like, Nerf carries with it often the connotation that people own particular things. So, yeah, I think there's something that goes on that sticks in people's craw, in particular when the cards they own, the characters they own, the whatever things they perceive as being in charge of those changing, rather than the rules to chess or something like that, which is more neutral.
Right, which is why I said to follow the sports analogy, you have to think of the teams as the players. The Minnesota Lakers were very upset when their object got nerfed.
The sports yeah. definitely carries this, but there's a lot just but any errata I think is cutting it too broad for what most people think of nerf.
Well, let's talk about changes to rule systems first. So, Richard, you're passionate about board games, and you know a lot about board game history. Can you speak to any systems changes that have to do with board games, sort of before collectible games and before digital object games came around?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most of my examples were from after.
board games. Just talking about board games.
So, yeah, with most... So, nerfing with it carries the connotation people own something, I think, or are personally affected in a strong way by the rules changes. So with board games that doesn't tend to happen. There's certainly plenty of errata, and we've seen a lot in recent years. Even Carcassonne changed the value with which farms were played, and there are. I forget, but people games do come out with errata, but these tend not to. I don't think people really view these as nerfing because they're not personally affected by it. It affects all players equally. Historically, most of these changes were originated, I think, by the play groups. For instance, Cosmic Encounter was a game in which most people would have said it strongly needed nerfing. As brilliant as it was, there were plenty of powers that were quote, overpowered, unquote. But the way that was handled was not by a company-mandated change. The company was probably out of business as soon as it was noticed. Each player group I played with had different rules. There were certain powers that were illegal. There were certain powers that were played in different ways, and that's just the way it was.
And you've talked before about Cosmic being a big influence on Magic. So as you went into the process of designing Magic, did you, obviously there was an effort to think about power level and about game balance, and I know that Magic was in playtesting for a long time, right? For a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
And yet still, I mean, can you talk about what happened when Magic was released? It got in the hands of so many more people. What was that process like, figuring out how the power levels were used once people got their hands on the cards?
Well, the power level of the game, once it got into people's hands, did not actually surprise us. We were far better players than the populace was when it first was released. This changed. Really, it changed when the Pro Tour started going into full swing. That's when we stopped being able to keep up with the player population. But until then, I would have matched any one of our players against any player outside of WotC. So then the question is, why were the cards so abusable? Well, part of it was because I was bringing in this standard from Board Game Pass, where play groups make their own balance changes. I knew that a deck of a lot of lightning bolts and mountains was pretty effective and no fun to play against, but I knew also that if somebody tried to play it against people, they wouldn't play it anymore. They would be shunned. Shunning was the
the nerfing?
Was the nerfing I anticipated. A lot of the things which we would regard now as being unbalanced, we didn't at that time because we didn't expect a lot of people to accumulate a lot of those cards.
Yeah, there's emails where we talk about we know the Moxes and the Lotuses and stuff are unbalanced among other cards. Many of the Power Nine specifically decks have been built around, and then we estimate what's the size of your play group going to be, and then we double that, And then how many cards are you going to buy each person across their lifetime? And then we triple that or quadruple that. And then we make a calculation as to how many Lotuses there's going to be in a playgroup. And, you know, the answer is, you know, 0.4 or whatever. And then you run through that calculation over and over again, and you find that some of the Power 9 are good, but they're not great. Certainly, you know, when you open an old sealed deck, if you have a Mox versus a, you know, a Shivan Dragon, you're probably better off with the Shivan Dragon, and you're definitely better off with a Fireball. So the power of the cards is always tied to, you know, your ability to collect a large number of them for those sorts of things. So there's emails which say, well, gosh, if we're wrong about this and these cards are a problem, then we're going to be rich. Because people are going to be buying a heck of a lot of Magic cards.
Surprise, surprise.
So, oh shucks, we were wrong. We were wrong. And that actually brings up an interesting point where a lot of people tend to think of balance in, especially for either digital object games or trading card or trading object games in general, tend to think of it in terms of the rules, like which card is broken rules wise. And that's actually not the important consideration. The important consideration is which cards and or strategies are broken for your player population. And it's a very different answer that you oftentimes get. If all of your players think that Walls of Wood are broken and everybody's playing Walls of Wood as many as they can cram into their deck, you've got a problem. You've got a problem because the game has problems when it goes out in the real world.
So let's actually quickly define what you mean by broken, because I think that term gets tossed around a lot, and I certainly have my definition of what I think it means, and I think that came out of my time at Wizards, but maybe we're operating with different definitions.
Sounds like your time at jail. My when I was doing time, we've all done time at Wizards.
We have, and
what we mean is strategic collapse.
Tell me more.
A game usually aspires to have a broad range of strategies which people can take. And if there are components in that game or rules in that game which make it so that one strategic path dominates the others, that can make it so that there's not a spectrum of strategies people can follow, but there might be one or two.
And two is equally bad as one. I mean, that's my general feeling. You can have the deck archetype or the unit, you know, archetype that you should play in an organized environment because it's going to beat most of the field, but then there can be one answer to that, but that's not a robust environment. That's a two-sided environment, and that's not that spectrum you're talking about.
No. Well, two's I think one is bad. And then each additional one gets better for a while, and then it starts getting too confusing, and it's probably better to cut them out.
Yeah, too many are bad as well. It's very difficult. It makes it much harder for new players to get into the game.
So, and I don't think there's a magic number that's right. Two, I think you're right, is probably in general going to be bad, but certainly I could imagine some play environments that are fun with two, at least for a while, because it could be not that one strategy beats the other, but it could be that both strategies are viable, but they, you know, involve different strategies. You could say that's like playing Terrans and Zerg. You know, that could be a really interesting game, even if both of them are viable.
Yeah, so it boils down to you need to pick, you know, sort of that number that you think is the healthiest for, you know, maybe continued sales of the game or involvement of the player base and ease of learning of the player base. There's a whole ton of considerations that go into not wanting to have too many, not wanting to have too few. Part of that, I know when we were looking at banning cards, was how many, not just how many decks there were, but were those decks rich in their variation? Because if they were, then you were a lot less concerned about there being two strategies.
Well, playing devil's advocate, I mean, the Moxes weren't a deck by themselves, right? So what led you down the path to...
So in particular, for Magic, there were... Again, this is sort of the overall health of the game thing. You might have a large number of viable strategies, and maybe they're viable because they're all... they're all first turn wins. Maybe there's, maybe you want there to be exactly five decks in the environment or five different major strategies. And if all of those five major strategies are first turn wins, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't help you. So there was a general problem of speed of the environment was one of the considerations for banning things in Magic. Another consideration for banning things in Magic, nerfing the things in Magic, was also the amount of money required to build a deck. We did not want that to go above a certain limit. And so that, of course, can always be fixed by reprinting cards, making the objects more freely available. We decided to not go that route because that would really hurt a lot of collectors.
I've heard that some companies have actually laid down the law and made it so that you're not allowed to nerf cards or equipment or make any bannings. It's an interesting contrast with what we did at Wizards. At Wizards, we were holding the developers accountable for how many bannings they had, but we actually felt like zero was not the target number. The system in these games is so complicated that if you shoot for zero and get zero, it's almost certain that you're not taking enough chances. Your product is probably not going to be the best it could be. You don't want too many bannings because they're a bad thing for a number of reasons, but if you don't get any, you're just being too conservative. So we viewed an ideal year at a certain point. We viewed it when there was one or two bannings a year and cards that were borderline banned, because this really showed that we were pushing the envelope with the game.
It's also kind of a timely conversation. Are you guys aware of the treasure cards in Zendikar? In the latest Magic expansion, they've taken actual old cards from and inserted them into the... They're not reprints. They're actual cards.
Yeah, that's crazy.
From old sets and insert those in at a sort of high random rate. I think the sense I get is, it was kind of one per pre-release kind of level
that's
of occurrence.
The numbers I was hearing. And yeah. It had some crazy stories associated with it. I was really surprised when I heard that they were actually real cards that they had just purchased.
I had figured maybe they came knocking on somebody's door. Maybe one of you guys are certainly... Mike has a huge basement full, as I understand it. Anyway, getting back to nerfing. So when you decided to pull the trigger was it the banned list in Type 2? Was that how that all came about?
There's a lot of different ways cards get nerfed. One is, if the strategy is broken for reasons of expense, you just reprint the cards. That was one approach we took. If the strategy is broken for some of the other reasons, there were a lot of different tricks used, like allowing you to have only one card in your deck. And then that began to become a problem over time because, you could build a great deck out of just one of. So then you needed to ban some cards. And then even that became a problem. And then because there were just too many cards in the environment, so you needed to maybe section it down. You did a major nerfing, which was in some of your primary tournament formats, you allow no card older than 2 years or whatever. And so sort of a wholesale nerfing. There were a lot of tricks, and they all slowly evolved over time. Until it was arrived at more or less the system that's used today. Interestingly, when Pokemon came around, which was a much less competitive game, we were hoping to get away with not having to do some of those things. Anytime you nerf, as Richard said before, these objects that people own, it's really bad because you're taking value out of their hands. So it's a tough proposition. You expect that you're increasing the value in the long term because you're keeping the game alive, but still doesn't get away from the issue that you're really hurting people at the moment you do it. So we really wanted to avoid that in Pokemon. And interestingly, it turned out enough people were playing it and playing it competitively enough. And the basic game system was so similar to other trading card games that we actually ended up more or less in the same place that we were with Magic.
So does the communication strategy, part of this, you brought up the importance of understanding who your players are and how they're playing and who they're playing with, the metagame aspects. Do you guys remember how you communicated these this tough thing that you're about to do. You're about to nerve. You're about to take value away from people. You're about to change something they're passionate about. Do you remember? Did you take feedback in? What was the process? Then ultimately, how was it communicated?
Well, there were a lot of things discussed. One was errata for cards, because then maybe they still get to keep their card, but you know, you're just changing the words on it, and that's just really bad for players, because it requires them to know a lot about what the changes are and be updated on the changes, and it was much easier to transmit to people a very simple, here's two cards you can't play with, rather than here's the new wording for these two cards. You know, then they got to carry that around with them, et cetera, et cetera. Much harder for that to transmit virally throughout the audience. So that was one quick thing early on as far as consideration for the players. And then the next thing was just always understanding that every time you nerf a card, you know, you're taking money out of somebody's pocket, and so it better pay for itself on the back end.
Did we touch on rule systems changes? Because it seems like we sort of went deep into the idea of items and rule system changes.
I mean, it's almost rule systems all have been changing over time for all games. They change to slowly evolve over time to combat strategic collapse or to make it so that the game doesn't last forever, or any of a number of different things can be addressed, or just introducing variety to the game. Another thing which is different about this, as I mentioned before, is historically, I think most of these changes are done by playgroup, but something different happened with Magic, where the playgroup was larger, more networked. I think it had a lot to do with the spreading over the internet. It made it so that it was a lot less satisfying for people to have house rules or to go to their local card shop and have whatever those house rules were. They really wanted a consistent set of rules, which that sort of demand wasn't nearly as strong for a game like Cosmic Encounter.
Yeah, the internet actually is a really good point, and that kind of brings you know, a lot of these obviously internet games run into this problem where local playgroups can't decide the issue because there's too many different local playgroups, and so you get this you know, democracy is fine for a small Greek city state, but not so much for a large modern nation. You need somebody actually, you know, running things. And so really the companies need to take over for these really, really large play groups, which is why I think you saw it, you know, in sports before you saw it in any other places, because they were played over by such a large population over large distances. You need these things like governing bodies. And then of course, Magic, you know, it happens, as Richard said. I think the playgroup size, because of the size of the tournament system and the internet, really helped a lot to I guess force the problem to be larger than local playgroups could handle.
Another thing about the balancing at the beginning, which I think we hinted on but it didn't really illustrate, was that the cards that are powerful are only powerful if you know what you're doing with them. So there was a story of an early tournament we ran. I think it was one of the early Rochester tournaments, if not the first Rochester tournament, where they were drafting off cards, and I was told there was somebody helping out who seemed to know what he was talking about, and watched the draft as a Black Lotus sat on the table and wasn't picked by anybody for, you know, until very late in the round, and he you know, his draw was dropping, and some of the people from R&D from Wizards, their draw was dropping, and afterwards they said, wow, I can't believe that they drafted so poorly, and the fellow who was helping him said, yeah, I love Black Lotus, first turn wall of wood. Bam, bam, bam. Three of them. And if that's how you're going to play it, it's really not that powerful.
Yeah, it's. I think it's something that's you hear a lot of game designers. This is one of the questions we got in China. You know, what mathematical model do you have? What's your spreadsheet, you know, for balancing the powers of the guys so that you know when someone's out of line or whatever? And the answer is, you know, you really, it's not about that. You don't care in the abstract if the things are balanced or not. What you care about is how it's played in the real environment. And this would happen a lot in Magic, where there would be supposedly broken decks, and we would sit back for a long time and we would say, they're not broken. Here's a deck that beats it. They're not broken. Here's a deck that beats it. And, you know, you keep saying that over and over and over again. And sometimes it will correct itself in the environment, and sometimes it wouldn't. So you'd have to step in and ban something.
Yeah, I will say that I've worked for different game companies after leaving Wizards, and most people believe there's a magical spreadsheet, and everybody tries to make one. And they do that, at least in part, because they don't have the manpower that we had at Wizards, with a lot of people playing a lot of games, a lot of really smart people playing a lot of games, to try to figure out what was going on and sort of handcrafting each card. It's a massive shortcut, and there are huge drawbacks to that system of relying on the spreadsheet. But I will say, I think it's a widespread conception that there should just be a black box. You put in the input of what it does, and a cost pops out the other side.
Yeah, the last spreadsheet I tried to make was Netrunner. And
Which there will be some people who say was a great game, but there is a specific criticism that's been leveled against it.
But and that's not what I'm going to talk about.
Oh, right, of course.
The spreadsheet I tried to make for Netrunner, I kept on trying to incorporate all the different facets of a card into a formula which would give me its cost. And after working on this for weeks and weeks, I realized that basically every time I added a card to the system, I had to add another column to my my spreadsheet, and basically I had I was never able to get anything as long, given that I had n balanced cards. I couldn't add an N plus first card to the system. I had to add another variable to the system. It was crazy.
Yeah, and I guess if the game, you know, if you'd lock the powers down to the game simple enough, then it might have worked. Of course, then that would limit your ability to sell expansions, because you know, in some sense, people want the new cards to be adding new columns to make them think about stuff in new ways. That's where they're the most interesting. The thing that I found the most funny about the system was, you know, Richard plugged in all these numbers, and it would spit you out a power number, and just because there was no reason not to do it, it saved all the digits. So, you know, these cards would be like, you know, the power of this card is 2.783927, and I started laughing because. People were wondering, you know, is this card a little bit better than that one because it's a hundredth off or whatever? And really, it's you would do well to have a system where there was even one significant digit. It's like your ratio of significant digits is somewhere between zero and one significant digits on all the card numbers.
Right.
Yeah, I think actually the most useful tool we've had for balancing these sorts of things is to just have it so that you pin down some cards, and once you've got those, you just compare everything to them.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly, yeah, Scaff and I have worked on cards, and you know, you need to know what the basic removal, single piece removal is, what mass removal is, what your basic turn one guy is, what your big brute is. I mean, those are the things that we would pin down, right?
Yeah, and even those change over time. I mean, they certainly have in Magic, but where you start.
Yeah, we've done that approach multiple times.
Yeah.
So let's take this now, if we can, sort of transition off the tabletop and into the video game or digital realm. Nerfing is something that World of Warcraft players are intimately familiar with, but let's talk for a second about sort of single player video game experiences and you know, games that after release, you know, the whomever at the company decides, between the time that the code was locked and it hit the brick and mortar shelves back when those were relevant, that something needed to get fixed. Any examples of that or thoughts about that process?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of computer games that are changed after they're released. In fact, it's been standard on PC for a long time that you load a game and it down, you know, you check to see what patches are out there. You download it. It might not even run without the patches. I'm beginning to think of nerfing as having these two components. One, it changes something you feel personally attached to. And the other is that it's being sent down to you from on high. It's a change being made by the man rather than your local playgroup. So of course, computer games that are being patched are being sent. The changes are being sent down by the man.
Can you think of a video game paradigm where the other one is true?
Well, the other one, yeah, you have it true in role playing games. In that you will already have a character in Diablo, for example. This is true whether you're playing single player or on Battle.net. They will patch it. If you're playing single player, you don't have to download that patch. But if you do download that patch, your character might become weaker.
I think he's saying, is there an example of a electronic game with where a local play group nerfs something? Is that what you're asking? Or,
well, I mean,
because so I have one.
Well, by all means.
When we were playing Diablo, Mike Donay had built this fire wizard or sorceress or whatever she was, and it was just ridiculous. And he was clearing off, you know, entire, you know, chapters in seconds as fast as he could run, and then we would play a couple local games, and in those local games we would say, okay, just don't build that, because it's boring to play with you if you build that. And so I think there's probably several examples like that. Another example is, I mean, this is, in a way, this is nerfing, say, Zerglings, but, you know, you play StarCraft and you say, okay, no rushing for...
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely.
You know, for 2 minutes, and that's not a Blizzard mandate. That's your local playgroup, which says essentially what they're saying there is Zerglings are too powerful.
So not an on-high nerf, but a local variant. I mean, do you have a distinction between a variant and a local play nerf, or are they basically the same?
Fundamentally the same thing? I would draw the line between nerf and variant as being whether somebody in particular is being hurt or profiting from it based on what they've invested in a character or in equipment or something like that. I mean, the line will be fuzzy because I may have invested a lot of time into perfecting my rush strategy, but in principle, if we say no rushing, I'm not... In some sense, I'm at a disadvantage because I've put a lot of time into practicing that, but I don't own the rush character or own the,
right,
the rush card. So there's
different than
it
the
feels
fire
different
wizard.
Than yeah. Than changing my equipment.
So let's talk about MMOs at least briefly. You know, that this is I think the most common nowadays, colloquially, what people know nerfing to be is a change to a spell or an attribute or a weapon in or a character class in an MMO that then brings down the power level. That's one way to approach it. Another way to approach it would be...
Well, and when you say bring down the power level, you mean bring down the relative power level. Because a lot of times you bring down the power level of something by just making something else better. You don't actually nerf in the strictest sense of the meaning of the word of, you know... putting nerf material around your sword, you or firecrackers or whatever. What you're doing is you're nerfing by unnerfing other things. That I think is a route that people tried to take because they somehow thought that was better.
And it is better. Well, I think people perceive it. I think when the changes come down in Warcraft now, there's definitely complaints because people aren't getting as many bonuses as they are, but it's not. I think there would be hell to pay if they actually, you know, it's like if characters were knocked, if characters and equipment were knocked down as much as they're improved.
Yeah, it's hard because various people at Wizards have threatened to quit their various MMOs under both situations.
I still think it's better, though. It's got to be better. For Wizards folks, maybe.
Here's one way which it may not be. You've got the most powerful character class around, and you're kicking butt. And if someone decides to nerf you, I think it's usually a lot easier for them to bring your power level in line with everyone else by making a small change to you than it is to creating a whole new thing for another character class.
No, well, it may be better from the point of view of easier to balance. I just think for PR purposes is better. And oftentimes it's such a complicated mess what they're doing. It's just like there's just a lot going on in these systems. And so I think typically it's not a matter of a World of Warcraft patch comes out and there's one sword which is overpowered and they're going to nerf it. Everybody's out of whack. There's aspects of this character that are too strong, this character is too weak, this equipment's too strong, this crafting's too weak, and they're just all pushed up and down.
It's just the thing I care the most about is my relative power level. And so if whatever you're going to do, I would much rather you, if I'm 20% better than the next guy, I'd much rather you lower me by 20% than create a new character class which is 50% better than the guy I am.
You shouldn't over-nerf the other guys, but I think if you've got six characters that are overpowered and six characters that are underpowered, and you can add 20% to the underpowered guys and make them perfectly balanced, that's going to be a lot better PR-wise than subtracting 20% from the others, and I think...
Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely right. I just thought it was easier to dial somebody back than... Because a lot of times when you try to bring people up, you can overshoot.
And in those kind of complex dynamic systems, I'm not sure there is an A to B equation in bringing something else up. Like, I don't know how you would...
They got a spreadsheet, just like I did.
They probably do have a spreadsheet.
Well, if anything, what I hear about Blizzard is that they actually do more of the handcrafting than the spreadsheeting.
It's handcrafting all the way.
Yeah.
And it's lots of playtesting.
Well, right. The playtesting is the... I mean...
That's right. That's what I mean by handcrafting is understanding that it's an art, not a science, and that you have to have players test it a lot and pay attention to each piece.
Right. Yeah, they're just so smart, so far ahead of, people that believe they can do it mathematically.
Excellent. Well, as we wrap this topic up, do you remember any time you were personally, emotionally hurt by a nerf that came down on something that you were in love with?
No. Every time anything of mine has been nerfed, I considered it a victory. because if I had a card in Magic that was banned and I was the one who made the deck, then that's great. I discovered it.
A badge of honor, if you will.
Yeah.
A nerf win.
And then I was done with it. I didn't have to play it anymore.
He's never had nearly as high a percentage of his net worth invested into Power 9 cards that then became banned as some people in the real world.
Fair enough. Well, any closing thoughts?
Just to stress that it's
relative power level, it's player perception.
It's player perception. That's the big thing to stress is that you don't really care about what the math says. What you care about is you're trying to take care of the play environment, and that's inherently based upon human fallibility. So that's what you got to take care of.
Yeah, and it's right. It is entirely perception, and that can be reflective of it's reflective of how people actually play the game. So, for example, with Warcraft 2, dragons were supremely overcosted for a player who knew what they were doing. But were they overcosted for the players at large? No, because we would go down to the game rooms and kids would be building dragons all day and all night. There'd be just dragons everywhere.
And flocks.
Yeah. And so, it's like if they made it cheaper, would the game experience be better for them? No, I don't think so. It would just meant that anybody trying any variant strategy would be all the more killed.
I remember specifically making some dragons in Magic with that same philosophy in mind. I know we did. Just one quick point. The communication between the players and you as the designers. Certainly the internet now has all these avenues. You can do a Twitter search about your game. You can have a Facebook.
I don't even
group.
Know what that is, by the way.
I'll show you later. But message boards being the most sort of the thing that's been around the longest, most people comfortable with. You obviously can't go off half cocked when a thread pops up with six people screaming that the house is on fire. Is there a strategy that you as the game designer can employ to figure out if there's a problem that needs addressing or if it's just people running around with their hair on fire?
There certainly are always people complaining to the heavens that everything's unbalanced and broken and going to hell. Certainly the issue of separating the fake cries from the real ones is a real one. And I would just say by looking at the actual environment and seeing how the game is playing in practice, if they're predicting doom, I don't know. That's hard to.
That's worth nothing.
That's hard to pay much credence to. But if when you go out there, that's actually what people are playing. Even if ultimately it's not the best strategy, if the environment is becoming unfun because people believe it's true, then you got to sit up and pay attention.
The one saving grace is that you the quality of the decisions you make along these lines matters a lot more if your game is a long-term game, a long-term high-revenue game. Then it's really important to get it right. But then you actually have time to wait things out. It's not like you got one summer and then no one's going to buy your game again. So it's
Let me give you a converse argument, which is if you realize after you've put your first set out or your first game out and you can catch something, an error that you've made early enough, isn't it better to make the change earlier in the game's lifespan?
That's true, but you better be damn sure, because you have no idea if it's really an error, because the game hasn't hit its broad player population yet. That may not even be an issue 6 months down the line.
Also, the error might be something which people really have a lot of fun discovering. Certainly with a lot of the broken cards in Magic's history, there's been talk that the game, that if it were balanced for its ultimate play, that it wouldn't have been as much fun for players to explore because it just felt broken at every turn.
Yeah, I think Richard's earlier thing about just loving the idea of causing a card to get banned is really, really important. Luckily, we're no longer in the situation where people have, say, tens of thousands of dollars worth of cards that are gonna go away, because of other changes we made to the environment. So the investments are all relatively reasonable, and getting one card of yours that you just bought banned is not gonna cost you a mint. And so it's great, to be the one that bans the card, it gets the card banned.
All right. Well,
make your friends cry enough, and you can win.
Yes, and whine enough on the boards. So. On behalf of Mr. Richard Garfield,
hola,
and Mr. Scaff Elias,
yeah, goodbye.
I'm Tyler Billen. Thanks for tuning in. We will catch you soon. May all your nerfs be delightful.
Yeah.
I can edit that out.
Can you
nerf that?